time which they was killing Iranian soldiers during the war with Iraq. We know those people when they was, I would love to say, leaking Saudi regime's shoes for getting a bunch of dollar or money or whatever, or support from a terrorist regime, as American regime. I really would like to know what's going on for about Sweden, actually. Sweden, a country which always talk about human rights and freedom and democracy, now are supporting and making a favor and show for a group which they have been in years in a terrorist list for whole world, international terrorist list.
The accusations against Nouri are mostly taken from members of this same group. The MKO has been accused of fabricating atrocities multiple times, again raising questions about the credibility of the prosecution, who wished to see Nouri sentenced to life. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Hundreds of civil servants inside the European Commission are working on a sixth round of sanctions against Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine. More Russian individuals, banks and media outlets are being targeted. There is also a proposal to completely stop the importation of Russian oil into the 27-country EU. Legislators say the measures will not only hurt Russia.
They will also affect the lives of European citizens with a direct impact on their homes, their jobs, their wallets.
A debate on Wednesday in the European Parliament heard that inflation in the EU is eating up wages and pensions. Apparently 36 million people in the bloc are unable to sufficiently heat their homes.
We should not talk about energy poverty anymore. We are talking about actual poverty. People who cannot pay their bills anymore. And therefore, my proposal is to organise a social summit.
The new social crisis and Ukrainian refugee crisis are placing additional pressures on EU health systems, including mental health services. Those working in the sector say there is not enough financial support from governments.
I have a lot of colleagues, they are leaving, they don't want to work as a nurse anymore because the pressure is too high. And because if you have a lot of people inside the houses that cannot pay the rent, they cannot afford to pay food, they cannot pay the gas and electricity, of course they are going to have mental issues.
Pope Francis says NATO's, quote, barking at Russia's door may have caused the conflict in Ukraine. Some EU lawmakers agree and suggest Washington is mostly to blame.
The US needs the war to reinforce the unipolar power, while Ukraine, the people of Europe and hundreds of millions in the global south will pay the price.
The European Commission's latest sanctions on Russia are presently just proposals.
Ban all Russian oil.
Hungary and Slovakia look set to veto the oil ban. There is growing concern surrounding how the Kremlin might respond to such a ban.
That's because Russia's gas is even more important to the EU's economy than its oil. Economists say if Moscow was to switch off the gas immediately, it would be game over for the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Monday, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, announced Italy's employment rate reached almost 60% in March, with more than 23 million people in work. The figure is the highest since 2004, when the agency started to keep track of such records. This as the country's economy is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic amid serious concerns over increasing energy prices. Some trade unions have expressed skepticism about the way the data is gathered by the Bureau of Statistics.
The increase in the number of employed people should be evaluated with great caution, as in most cases it's temporary or petty jobs. Employment figures are made to look impressive, to show that the economy has picked up again, but the reality is very much different. Over time, insecure work has become prevalent in Italy, and workers are being blackmailed into accepting longer working hours and low wages.
Another point to consider is the definition of an employed person. For the majority of Western countries, statistical agency, working just 1 hour a week would be enough to be classified as an employed individual. Another report carried out by research institute Censis and trade union UGL shows that Italian salaries fell by over 8% in real terms between 2010 and 2020, The report has also highlighted the problem of in-work poverty in Italy.
Wages are really low, long working hours. It's difficult, very difficult.
Lo dico io personalmente perché...
Who better than me can tell you how hard it is to find a job? I have been looking for work for a year. The only time I found something, I was paid badly and off the books.
Over 13% of employed workers and almost 8% of the self-employed had earnings below the poverty line in 2020, up 3 percentage points compared to 2010. Italy is one of the few European countries without a minimum wage. A boom in temporary and on-call contracts in recent years and fragmentation in union representation have led to an increase in badly paid, undignifying jobs. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
One of the psychologists paid tens of millions of dollars by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to oversee the interrogation of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror, provided new details about the torture of a Guantanamo Bay detainee at CIA black site in Thailand. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, All of These Guys Belong in Prison, CIA Torture, described in vivid detail by psychologists. Here's more. One of the psychologists paid tens of millions of dollars by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to oversee the interrogation of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror, provided new details about the torture of a Guantanamo Bay detainee at CIA black site in Thailand. The New York Times reports James E. Mitchell told a military judge during a pretrial hearing at Guantanamo that Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, a Saudi national facing possible execution for allegedly masterminding the deadly 2000 bombing of USS Cole in Yemen, broke quickly under torture and became so obedient that he would crawl into a cramped confinement box before guards ordered him to do so. Initially, guards had to force al-Nashiri into the box, but according to Mitchell, the prisoner liked being in the box and would get in and close it himself. Annie W. Morgan, a former Air Force defense attorney who is a member of al-Nashiri's legal team, told the Times that when she heard Mitchell's testimony, got the image of crate training a dog and became nauseous. That was the goal of the program, to create a sense of learned helplessness and to become completely dependent upon and submissive to his captors, she added. Referencing a tactic taught in U.S. torture programs and documents dating back to 1950s. Gail Held, a former CIA analyst who advocates Guantanamo's closure, tweeted, "Imagine the hell Mr. Nashiri experienced outside of that box that made him prefer being inside it." Nashiri's attorneys, who argued that evidence in the case is tainted by torture, questioned Mitchell about what happened at Thailand black site in November 2002, when former CIA director Gina Haspel oversaw the secret prison. The psychologist's testimony is meant to shed light on abuse that may have been recorded on scores of videotapes documenting detainee torture that were later destroyed at the behest of then CIA counterterrorism chief Jose Rodriguez, who claimed in his memoir that Haspel drafted the 2005 cable ordering the move. Mitchell, who along with fellow psychologist John Bruce Jessen, was paid $81 million by the CIA to develop and supervise an interrogation regimen for terrorism suspects, described how the diminutive Anashiri was so scrawny that guards stopped subjecting him to the interrupted drowning torture commonly called waterboarding for fear the prisoner might be seriously hurt. In addition to waterboarding and other approved torture techniques, a declassified 2014 U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee report revealed how interrogators threatened to sexually assault Anashiri's mother and how he was terrorized with a power drill and raped. Mitchell told the court that one interrogator used a belt to strap Anashiri's arms behind his back and lift him up from behind to his tiptoes. Mitchell said he objected after the prisoner howled in pain. Fearing his shoulders would be dislocated, the torture continued. Guards forced the shackled prisoner onto his knees, then bent him backward with a broomstick placed behind his knees. In a bid to train Anashiri to call him sir, the chief interrogator gave him a cold bath before scraping a stiff bristled brush from his to his face and his mouth. The Times previously reported interrogators continually told Mr. Anashiri they did not believe he was telling everything he knew, threatening him with worse treatment if he did not tell them more. The prisoner, already subjected to the whole array of CIA torture techniques, loud noise, sleep deprivation, forced nudity, wall slamming and waterboarding, insisted he was trying to remember and tell them everything. But the interrogators appear to have ultimately concluded that Mr. Anashiri was not lying. Some of the cables back to headquarters, apparently written by Ms. Haspel, described him as compliant and cooperative. According to the 2014 report on the interrogation program by the Senate Intelligence Committee. In addition to the black site in Thailand, Anashiri, who was captured in Dubai in October 2002, was imprisoned at CIA black sites in Afghanistan, Poland, Romania, and possibly Morocco before being sent to Guantanamo in September 2006. In 2010, he was granted victim status by the Polish government, whose cooperation with and complicity in George W. Bush administration's extraordinary rendition and torture program was later revealed and investigated. In March, human rights advocates condemned the U.S. Supreme Court's decision allowing the Biden administration to block Mitchell and Jessen from cooperating with police prosecutors investigating the torture of Saudi terror suspect Abu Zubaydah. The Bush administration officials who devised, approved, and implemented the post-9/11 torture regimen have enjoyed total impunity. Not only did Bush's successor, former President Barack Obama, break a campaign promise to investigate and prosecute abuses as required by U.S. and international law, his Justice Department actively shielded them from accountability as torture continued at Guantanamo.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the Islamic Republic. He was received by the leader of Iran's revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who had kind words for him. He said that Syria enjoys a higher degree of respect and credit, and that all countries look upon it as a power. What does Syria's hard-fought status in both political and military arenas mean in the context of regional countries who used to act against it with the support of the U.S.? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Syria's re-entrance into the region has been embraced by regional countries, which spells the end of U.S. dominance and influence. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magnier joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, and political analyst from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. If I may first start with you, Elijah Magnier, and get your reaction to what Iran's leader has said. Quote, today Syria is not the same Syria that it was before the war. Syria enjoys a higher degree of respect and credit, and all countries look upon it as a power.
Thank you for having me. Syria is one of the rare countries who refused to normalize with Israel and declare Israel as an enemy and supported the Palestinian cause and refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony, notwithstanding the war waged on Syria since 2011. That's a very important point. Secondly, Syria is part of the axis of the resistance that reject the U.S. hegemony and fight for the oppressed people and to support the Palestinian cause and refuse any truce with Israel or normalization of the relationship like other countries in the Gulf. Third, the number of countries that were involved in the war in Syria, dozens of nations led by the U.S. to change the regime and create a failed state and allow the jihadists that were trained by the Americans and their NATO allies in Syria, in Jordan, in Turkey, this is a big victory for Syria and its allies, mainly Iran and Russia, who interfered in the war in Syria to the request of the government in Damascus in different stages in 2011, 2013, and 2015. That is very significant. Today, Syria has a different position where different Middle Eastern countries are trying to normalize the relationship and bring them back as they were before 2011, but they are forbidden by the Americans to regain this relationship, and Syria is not rushing toward them. It's reinforcing the relationship with Iran, that holds more or less the same ideology and objectives against the Israelis and to support the oppressed, supporting the access of the resistance and rejecting any U.S. hegemony mm-hmm. over the country.
So, Marcus Papadopoulos, how do you go from what, as our guest there said, it's really incredible if you think about it, how many countries were involved in this war on Syria and how they really just went all out for so many years, to now Syria being received by these countries. Of course, we can talk about the UAE, which has warmly embraced Syria, both the foreign minister visiting Syria and then Assad visiting the UAE. And these are, of course, Arab countries that were backing this these terrorists. Why are they welcoming Syria now?
Well, the victory of the Syrian people in the war waged against them by the West through Western proxies, namely numerous terrorist groups, constituted a turning point, not just for the Middle East, but for the world as a whole. Though we should be mindful that not all of Syria has been liberated by the Syrian army, because there are two NATO countries inside Syria and illegally occupying Syrian territory. Thus, in the northeast, we have the Americans, and in the northwest, we have the Turks together with Al-Qaeda. But nevertheless, the victory of Syria really was quite astonishing, given everything that the Americans, the British, the French, the Turks, the Saudis, and the Israelis confronted the Syrian people with, not just in terms of the tens of thousands of terrorists which were deployed into Syria, but also the array of weaponry which was sent to them. So it really was a remarkable victory. And what we can say is this, that as a result of Syria's victory, an unofficial alliance comprising Syria, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah has emerged in the Middle East. And that unofficial alliance is now confronting American supremacy in the Middle East. And whilst I'm not saying that the American stranglehold over the Middle East is on the verge of collapse, nonetheless, the Syrians, the Iranians, the Russians, and Hezbollah are able to limit the maneuvering of the Americans in the Middle East, which is good for peace in the Middle East, it's good for stability in the Middle East, and it means the Americans don't have the same kind of maneuverability to instigate another war in the Middle East as they have done on previous occasions.
Well, all of this comes, as you mentioned, I think Elijah Magner alluded to, in the face of the U.S., who says that it still stands against this, what it has called normalization, with what it considers to be the regime in Syria, as the U.S. Claims. They have slammed attempts, for example, by the UAE to have started this process, and they have said, as we have said it before, this administration will not express any support for efforts to normalize or to rehabilitate Bashar al-Assad. How is it that you have an ally like the UAE of the U.S., if I may say that? I mean, I'm not too sure if they're on solid footing right now, but how do you go from being an ally to what the UAE has done? Maybe the fallout maybe one of the reasons could be UAE's approach towards Syria.
Well, in politics, everything is possible. There aren't any swear enemy forever, including Saudi Arabia. The investment that Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar have made in Syria in supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS is huge. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars, as the Qatari foreign minister said in one of his interviews a couple of years ago. So today we see the Emiratis already establishing a diplomatic relationship with Damascus since a couple of years now. However, they are prevented from increasing and turning this diplomatic relationship into commercial relationship. Now, all that is because the Biden administration doesn't have a strategic view of what to do in Syria and hopefully that will turn in the favor of the Syrian government, where they must start activating the resistance against the Turkish and the U.S. occupation forces, as your guest rightly said, in the north, east, and west. Now, the Saudis also don't have a good relationship with this current U.S. administration. However, there are some lines that are not crossed so far, like returning and regaining relationship with Syria, because they believe that this is a gift to President Assad that the Americans are not yet willing to do, waiting for the Syrian opposition to regain some strength from I don't know where, because they finished. And today we have only Al-Qaeda in Turkey in the north and the American and their proxies, Kurds. So any plan is a failed plan, and they have to be convinced to regain relationship with the central government in Damascus.
Yeah, I almost forgot that there was a Syrian opposition. I'm not too sure how they're getting their funding. Marcus Papadopoulos, what is interesting here is the fact that you have the interest, to say the least, from the UAE to expand its business relation with Syria. And it has actually opened up the doors towards that. We can talk about the telecom sector, I believe, and also in the arena of electricity. But the sticking point here is the fact that you have the U.S. sanctions that are in place. Now, if they move ahead with those, then they will be in breach of sanctions. They're showing a keen interest, UAE, in expanding their relationship in the business arena. So how can they when these sanctions are in place?
Well, politics is a strange business. One day you are at war with another country, and the next day you are trading with that country. Prior to the war in Syria in 2011, Syria had a lucrative trading and business relationship with countries such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and UAE. And because the efforts of the West to topple the Syrian government and to impose a pro-Western puppet government in Damascus failed, and failed abysmally, there are countries in the Middle East which wish to resurrect its previous lucrative business dealings with Syria. So as you've already mentioned, UAE is one of them. And I have no doubt that at some point in the future, sooner rather than later, the Saudis will do the same and the Turks will do the same. And I also believe the British and the French will do the same. And as regards possible sanctions on a country such as the UAE, which of course is a strategic partner to Washington, well, we have to bear in mind that whilst the Americans exercise tremendous influence in UAE, I do not believe that UAE is a puppet of the Americans, certainly not like how Serbia or Ukraine is a puppet of the American government. So I believe that UAE sees a very important imperative, an important economic imperative in re-establishing its trade relationship with Syria. And I do not believe that the Americans will impose sanctions on UAE, because the Americans are acutely aware that they do not have the kind of maneuverability in the Middle East that they once had as a result of, as I mentioned earlier, the unofficial alliance of Syria, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah. The Americans are not going to sanction any of their allies in the Middle East at a time when American mastery in the Middle East is being challenged. That would simply be suicidal for the Americans.
Sure. Well, you know, it's very confusing to know what is the policy, Elijah Magnier, of the U.S. when it comes to Syria. I mean, really, even throughout the war, it was kind of confusing. I think it was categorized as an obsession with Assad being, thrown off or for his position to get changed. Kind of like the same way that they're looking at Putin. Nevertheless, a question comes to mind. A, what is the U.S. position now when it comes to Syria and Assad? And B, what right does the U.S. even have to dictate and decide for other countries in the region with whom it should have a relationship with?
Well, first of all, the Americans don't have any right to dictate anything on any country any sovereign country. However, because they are not accountable, they don't feel they need to ask permission from anyone, including the United Nations. That's one. Two, the Americans, the current American administration is really following what President Donald Trump has done in Syria and in other parts of the world, at the exception of the relationship with Russia. So we saw that he kept the Americans' forces in Syria, and he kept the American forces in Iraq, despite the rejection of the Syrian government and the Iraqi parliament of the U.S. Forces' presence in their respective countries. Now, Biden doesn't have a policy in Syria. He has one very specific policy to try and starve the population by controlling the oil and the food that is represent the biggest supply of the country in the northeast, where the U.S. forces are occupying. And he is also blocking the road and the borders on the Tanf between Syria and Iraq. So when he is doing that and preventing Jordan from regaining relationship with Syria, preventing the Arab Gulf countries from doing so, he is aiming to cripple the Syrian economy. That is his only clear policy. Otherwise, he doesn't have any other policy that is visible apart from that, because, first of all, Russia has defeated the U.S. and NATO in Syria. Iran has defeated the U.S. and NATO in Syria by spoiling their objective and making sure that they will never reach the objective to create a failed state in Damascus. And thirdly, because Hezbollah became stronger due to the Syrian war. So giving Syria as a reward to Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah, this is not something that the Americans are very much willing to do. That's why they're keeping the forces in the north, and I don't think Biden will withdraw ever from a country without a local resistance.
So we need to connect the dots here between different entities that are involved here, Marcus Papadopoulos, and perhaps he can help us out here. So in terms of looking at the side where we want to see what U.S.'s position is, maybe it's good to bring Israel in here. And the reason why I'm bringing Israel in here is because you have the UAE that has normalized ties with Israel. So the U.S., who knows what's going on in terms of their policy, but Israel has formalized ties with the UAE, who has ties with Syria. So can you please explain to us how these relationship works when it comes to Syria?
Very quickly, the cardinal factor as to why the Americans attempted to overthrow the Syrian government was to eradicate Russian influence and power in the Middle East. Why? Because Syria, historically, has been Russia's eyes and ears in the Middle East. That's why Washington attempted to destroy the Syrian government through the use of terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But as regards to how relations between Israel and a number of countries in the Middle East, Arab countries in the Middle East, have been normalized, such as UAE, well, that is, in my opinion, America's response to the victory of the Syrian people in the war in their homeland, because the Americans, through getting their allies in the region, such as Israel and UAE, to normalize their relationship with one another, that not only strengthens Israel, but it also, as a result, strengthens America's position in the Middle East. So whilst it is very true that America's position in the Middle East has been weakened somewhat by the victory of Syria in the war, nonetheless, the Americans are still able to bring together their allies in the region as a way of augmenting their mastery in West Asia. No different to how the Americans have formed a partnership in the Eastern Mediterranean involving Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, sure, and Saudi Arabia. So we need to be very mindful that the Americans, whilst they've been weakened in the Middle East, they are anything but a spent force there.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree, Elijah Magner, the way the media is reporting this and the way it's being reported in general in terms of the way that these overtures, if you want to call it, are being done between the Persian Gulf countries and Syria is one key motive, and that is said to stop the influence of Iran with Syria. But we see Assad visiting Iran today, meeting with the leader who received them very warmly. And at the same time, you have the current administration, the 13th administration, headed by Ebrahim Raisi, who has made it a point, A, to establish close ties with regional countries, and B, Iran is in the middle of talks with Saudi Arabia, which there are talks of even the embassies opening up. So if you have that going on, how can there then be a relationship between these Arab countries with Israel, the ones who have formalized, when Israel's bombing Syria? Because they want to make investments in that country. At least that's part of the talk and report that they want to establish.
Well, look, we've seen the relationship between Russia and Turkey is a very strategic and excellent relationship, but they disagree on Syria. We've seen also the relationship between Iran and Turkey going into a very good level, but they disagree also on Syria because both Russia and Iran believe in the sovereignty of the Syrian state. Now, the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia is regaining. However, the Saudis are still occupying Yemen and not releasing all the goods to lift the sanctions on Yemen. So there are differences that can be organized in some countries and disagreed upon in other countries. Now, this is going to happen between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the regaining of the diplomatic relationship this month, because that is important, particularly when Iran shows strengths and its ability to stand against the U.S., and the nuclear deal is about to happen anytime if the Americans agree on the full Iranian terms. That's why it is in the advantage of the Saudis to have good ties with a strong country like Iran that is capable of defending itself and showed its capability, particularly after bombing the Mossad base in Iraq just a couple of weeks ago. Showing the Iranian capability, threatening Israel, and the Saudis having good relationship with Israel, they are two different things. The Saudis are pleasing the Americans. The Saudis are afraid of the Americans' reaction. They want to have good ties with the Israelis, but that doesn't mean the population in the Middle East agree what their leaders are doing, particularly in the Emirates, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Jordan. There are different things here.
Well, a final question, Marcus Papadopoulos. So when it came to Syria, Saudi Arabia and the allies and a bunch of countries that were on the same page, they lost that war. When it comes to Saudi Arabia, they have pretty much lost the war in Yemen. I'm guessing that they're saying, okay, it's time to maybe move and regroup with regional countries, Syria being one of them. The resistance, this is part of the resistance of this area, Syria, one part of that equation. When these countries align themselves with Syria, will that be the final blow for the U.S., in a sign that it should move out of the region?
While Saudi Arabia may have lost the war in Yemen, they have still nevertheless slaughtered over 200,000 Yemeni men, women and children through the use of British and American weapons. But the world is witness to the emergence of a very powerful Iranian state. And that is a reality that the Saudis cannot ignore. So the Saudis have two options. They can either have a war with Iran, which would be catastrophic for the Saudis, or they can have some sort of relationship with the Iranians. And that is why I believe that Riyadh will opt for the latter. They will establish some sort of relationship with Iran, because otherwise the Saudis could become embroiled in a war with the Iranians, and Saudi Arabia would be decimated, and the American hold over the Middle East would be then in serious jeopardy.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you for that, Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, political analyst. Elijah Magner, pleasure, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Betahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
In the limelight. Anxiety is never going to be fun, but it can be healthy. And facing up to it is always better than hiding. We have prepared for you an article written by Kate Smith. The piece is titled, Anxiety Can Be Good For You. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Dr. Tracy Dennis-Tiwari was a professor of psychology immersed in research, evaluating which mental health treatments worked and why, when she first became aware of an uptick in anxiety. This was some 15 years ago in New York City. She says, I worked closely with practicing clinicians and I remember one of them saying, I'm seeing all these parents and kids coming in and they're talking about anxiety the way we used to talk about stress. She added, everything is about anxiety. Back then, Dr. Dennis-Tiwari believed treatments would make a difference. She says, I thought we were going to claw this back, but the opposite happened. Instead, that uptick became an avalanche. Today, anxiety disorders are the most common mental health issue in the United States, affecting 30% of adults. In Britain, prescriptions for anti-anxiety medications have almost doubled over the past 15 years, with a sharp rise among the under-25s. In the US, prescriptions have quadrupled. In 2021, a survey of 8,000 children led Oxford University Press to name anxiety as the word of the year. Dr. Tracy Dennis-Tiwari says, it's the word on everyone's lips, the challenge of the moment. We have configured ourselves to think of ourselves as an anxious society. We have a million great self-help books, scientifically validated treatments. We have 30 different anti-anxiety medications, but the field has not kept pace with the treatment and prevention of physical disease. None of it is sticking. She notes, I was part of the problem, however well-intentioned, until I started to wake up about a decade ago and began thinking, wait a second, what are we saying to people? The idea that anxiety is something to manage or eradicate, a habit to be broken, is wrong and actually doing us harm. It's literally a recipe for more anxiety. This is the central message in Dr. Tracy Dennis-Tiwari's new book, Future Tense. She concludes that the problem isn't anxiety itself, but our beliefs about it and our attempts to avoid it, which are not only destined to fail, but also to make us weaker and more fragile. It's a vicious cycle. Help reframe anxiety as an ally and not an enemy, Future Tense takes a deep dive into the emotion itself. Dr. Tracy Dennis-Tiwari says, anxiety is very different to fear. Fear is the certainty that something bad is happening to you. Anxiety is about uncertainty. It's the feeling that something bad could happen, but might not. It's the discrepancy between where you are and where you want to be. So you're anxious about failing your exams, finding your first job. She says, anxiety is designed to feel bad. Your heart races, your blood vessels contract, so you sit up and listen, adding, "But unlike fear, anxiety contains hope." Our dopamine levels increase. That's the feel-good hormone that happens when we're rewarded. The distant prospect of acing those exams, of getting a clean bill of health, or landing your chosen career is the dopamine talking. Anxiety can focus the mind, drive you to revise harder, to see a doctor, to seek new pathways towards your chosen career. Dr. Dennis Tiwari says, "It's a horrible emotion. It feels terrible. But it's a beautiful emotion as well." The key distinction between anxiety and an anxiety disorder is functional impairment, when our ways of coping impede our normal life. Perhaps we stop leaving the house. In cases of obsessive compulsive disorder, we might create rituals to dampen the feelings. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari advocates treatments like exposure and response prevention, a cognitive behavioral therapy which helps patients confront whatever they're anxious about. But her biggest wish is to change our approach at a much earlier stage so that anxiety won't drift into a disorder. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, "First, it's the understanding that being anxious is not a malfunction. It's a helpful and useful," adding, "If you wake up with that feeling, it's worth tuning in and sitting on it for a while. Why are you feeling like this?" She gives the example of her first pregnancy when she learned that her son would require open-heart surgery within months of his birth. Her anxiety was off the scale, but it energized her to do everything in her power to minimize the odds of the worst outcome imaginable. She gathered knowledge from every paper ever published about her son's condition. She found the best possible surgeon. She planned for every contingency. Anxiety helps us forge forwards with creative solutions, but there are times when there is little we can do to address a future uncertainty. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari suggests many ways of coping here. Connecting with friends and family is a soothing first step. Cultivating things that immerse you in the present moment is also helpful. She says, "Mindfulness is one technique, but whatever works for you. Exercise is an incredible way to find flow and bring yourself to the present. Music, whether you perform or listen to it. Walking in nature, I love to write poetry. Bad poetry most of the time, but it leads me to a state of expansive thinking. Making a daily to-do list can claw back some sense of control and achievement. The worst possible response is to instead stamp out the feelings or attempt to avoid it." Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says humans are anti-fragile. We only strengthen and grow when challenged. She says, "Our emotional systems are like our immune systems. If our immune system isn't exposed to germs, it remains weak. If our muscles aren't used, atrophy sets in. It's only by feeling our anxiety, listening and acting on it, that we cope better next time." For this reason, Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari expresses grave concerns over our creeping collective anxiety avoidance techniques, like safe spaces and trigger warnings. She says, "I think they're counterproductive, and so far the evidence suggests that too. What they tend to do is inform someone that they're not up to the task and that difficult emotions are harmful." Snowplow parenting is another counterproductive development. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, here in Manhattan, it has replaced the helicopter parent. This removal of obstacles, fixing things before they've happened. I know it's so hard being a parent, it takes everything for me not to step in. But we have to have faith in our kids, acknowledge their emotions, show we have confidence they can figure it out. We need to help them through, not around. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, this speaks to me. In 2020, my youngest daughter was the target of some harmful behavior at her school. She came off her phone. She caught contact with her friends. Within weeks, the schools had closed. Two, the country in lockdown, and my daughter's anxiety over ever going back or making new friends was sky high. I was so tempted to lift that weight off her back by telling her she never had to. I came close. I thought about moving house. I inquired about other schools. I researched homeschooling. But then what? At some point, she'd have to step back into the world. The kids from her school lived all around us. On social media, they'd never be more than a click away. I knew that the best outcome was the hardest, to go back. She says, strangely, in the months that followed, my daughter used many of the methods outlined in Future Tense. She filled notebooks with lists that she carefully ticked off each day. At first, they were basic. Shower, wash hair, but as she began to follow interests and find meaningful distractions, teenagers without phones have a lot of hours to fill, they became more character building. Meditate, French Duolingo, leg workout with weights. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, my own anxieties brought some horrible physical effects, loss of appetite, my clothes stopped fitting. But my mind whirled with ideas, new ways to build her up. Some actually worked. She attended a film course where she bonded with a girl over a shared interest, still one of her closest friends. Though we weren't going on holiday that summer, I asked a family in Madrid, Spain, if they knew a teenage girl interested in a fortnight's exchange. My daughter returned from that trip the happiest and most relaxed I'd ever seen her. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari concludes by saying, at school, it probably took a full year before my daughter felt safe in new friendships. Anxiety brought her to rock bottom, but by sitting with it, getting through, not around, she's deeper, stronger, and so much wiser. I couldn't be prouder. It's horrible, it feels terrible, but it's beautiful too.